shop. For this recent result we have on pseudorandom number generators based on the DDH assumption would be nice. And then realizing that a slot is say about an hour, I decided to mix in some other results that we achieved over the past year or so, mainly in joint work with one of the PhD students at Eindhoven University, namely Andrei Sidorenko, and also with Reza Farasai. So here's the plan. Looks a bit long, but I thought let's put it out there. So in red you see the main topic of the talk, the main result, and in blue you see some of the other results. I like to start out gently with revisiting a basic problem, namely the problem of generating a random number in a given interval, given access to a source of random bits. So you have to convert the bits to numbers somehow. And maybe you know of Bleichenbacher's attack on the DSA standard, the algorithm, that was based on a slight bias in the random nonce generated in the beginning of the DSA signature algorithm, and that enabled Bleichenbacher to mount an attack, at least to cryptanalyze the algorithm. So the NIST, I think, responded with fixing that part of the algorithm. And then I will go to the general goal of achieving good concrete security for provably secure pseudorandom number generators. And well, a few years ago we started out by focusing on RSA-based schemes, and mainly the Bloom-Bloom-Shoup generator, and also the Vajirani-Vajirani result for that. After some time we were a little bit disappointed in the results that you get for that BBS generator, because the reduction that is part of the security proof is rather inefficient and nevertheless optimal or near to optimal. So following a reductionist approach in that case doesn't lead to very satisfactory results. We don't get a very good concrete security. That means it translates in using a Bloom-Bloom-Shoup generator with a huge RSA model, say of 10,000 bits or even larger. So now we tried our luck in the DL setting, discrete log setting, and well, ultimately that led to this one, which we found in a somewhat roundabout way, anyway, we found it. So before that time we actually looked at these things, and I will briefly discuss them as well. So that gives some background for the DDH generator, as we call it, which as I will show to you is a very simple pseudorandom generator and with a tight connection to the DDH problem. So here is this basic problem, which you probably all encountered at some point. Maybe at some point you realized when you can write protocols on paper and you say that X has to be selected from ZQ or something between 0 and Q, uniformly random. So paper is patient, as you say in Dutch, maybe also in English. That doesn't complain, but if you have to type it into a program, then you wonder, oh, how should I do that, given access only to a source of random bits, because that's what a basic pseudorandom generator gives you, bits. So then it's not too much effort to probably reinvent algorithm number one, where you aim at perfectly random numbers, perfectly uniform numbers, by simply taking a sufficiently long bit string of the same length as the target number, capital B, and then you test whether X is in the interval, and if so, you accept it, and you have a uniformly random choice. If not, you start all over again. It means that you have to throw away all the random bits that you've used so far. And on average, in the worst case, so average, and then in the worst case, if the bound is just the power of 2 plus 1, you will use 2 runs of this basic algorithm, of this basic step, and it means that you, on average, are wasting n bits. So you're wasting as many bits as you actually need, factor 2. So there's also this alternative, which you could say falls into a different category, because it doesn't achieve perfect uniformness, but it will always run in the same time, and it will always waste k bits for the quality of this distance to the uniform distribution. So these are the well-known folklore algorithms, and actually these are the only ones mentioned in the draft that also contains the proposal for the dual elliptic curve generator, which is the draft in this draft written by Barker and Kelsey. And but they don't mention any other algorithms, but somehow this is not very satisfactory, that you have to use twice as many bits as you would actually need, because the entropy, of course, for this problem is n bits, and then you waste some extra. So I'll switch immediately to a very simple algorithm that we found, maybe rediscovered, but we didn't actually see this algorithm in literature. It works as follows. You're going to generate the number x bit by bit, starting at the most significant bit. And you compare it to the upper bound b minus 1, to the bits of that one. And then it's almost automatic once you decide to solve this problem, say in this direction, you automatically get this result, that if the bit is already larger than the corresponding bit in the bound, then you have to quit, give up on x, and start all over again. If the bit happens to be equal, and if you're in this case all the bits so far have been equal, then you must continue with the next bit. You're just walking along the border on the bound. And finally, if you are well, and these are bits actually, if you're within the bound, then you can go run simply by appending random bits to x without any checking until you reach the desired length. So again, like this actually generates perfectly uniform numbers. And for that, it uses, of course, n bits, that's the minimum you need, plus some waste. So the question is, what's the waste? And now the point is that this is, although this is a very simple algorithm, if you start to analyze it, and if you start by, because that would be your maybe your first idea, to determine the probability distribution for this random variable, the number of bits that is used, and the probability that the number of bits used is equal to k, and you start to evaluate those things, that's cumbersome, and maybe you would even give up after some point, because you have to do all kinds of say nasty things in terms of this bound and recurrence relations, which are quite nasty. So fortunately, there's an easy way out, and we do this by actually not computing the probability distribution first. We actually did it. You can still do it, but computing the average value from that distribution is still somewhat nasty. But if we just aim at computing the average directly, then we get a solution quite easily. So this is similar maybe to this trick that you know somehow, that you at some point saw or realized, that if you have to determine the outcome for this geometric series, then of course what you usually do, you have to do this inventive step. Oh, you take 1 minus r, that side, and then suddenly it's there. But you can also say, well, I take this sum, and then I'm going to aim at the recurrence. So I want to obtain the same sum again. So I split off the first term, and then I have this extra factor r, and take it out, and then we solve for s. And then actually the series converges if r is smaller than 1, etc. But even if r is greater than 1, this gives a solution, if you like. So you can do this for more complicated quantities and reuse the result we just got. And so you hardly have to think, no generating functions and derivatives and sometimes confusing. You just do it like this. So that's what actually did for this algorithm. And then this is the exact result. Behind this is a conditioning on a certain event. I'm not going into details there, but if you pick that conditioning, you will see that the expected number of bits is the n, as you expect, and this is then the waste. But the waste is easily upper bounded by 3, so it's constant. We went from n bits waste to 3 bits of waste. So that's quite good. And you can also, again, average now over all possible bounds B of the same length, and then it will even drop to a bit and a little bit. So that, for all practical purposes, that's kind of okay. Now, well, we were very happy with this at the time, but at some point we were told that back in the 70s, Knut and Yao already did this kind of problems, and they solved it optimally and even better than I just showed. It's not a big difference anymore, but it's better because the result is optimal. The point is, however, we researched literature, and then lots of recent papers never mentioned this result. So there's different areas in the literature which are in some sense disjoint, but we know it now anyway. So here's actually a nice drawing by my colleague Benny de Weger that visualizes the basic idea of the Knut-Yao approach to get an optimal solution. And here optimal means the minimal number of random bits used to generate the numbers here, modulo 13. So the idea is that you start out, well, actually with no bit, but then you flip a coin, take one random bit, and then you have two possibilities. You do that a couple of times until you have a sufficient number of nodes here, namely 16. And then we can harvest some results. So the algorithm then says that if you're in one of these upper nodes, then you take the associated number. So if I arrive at this node by the random flips, I take this number. And that's a uniform, will be uniform. And these three, we don't throw them away, but they are recycled. And well, three is not enough, so then you go up again and you see this effect. And then, because the multiplicative order of 2 modulo 13 is 12, you will cycle. And that's all very nice. So we were a little bit disappointed, but there's still some hope. First, let me point out that they even did this for any probability distribution, and then they showed that the waste, is this the pointing stick or the? Well, here's another nice stick. Oh, it's such an electronic stick.
You could turn up everything.
Sort.
Huh? You could remote turn up everything.
Yeah, okay, thank you. So with less than 2 bits waste, on average, you can do this for any probability distribution. So that's very nice. But if we switch to, say, the context of secure multiparty computation, which I happen to do every now and then, there's still some use for our simple algorithm, because in that setting, it's not only the random bits that are expensive to generate, the jointly random bits, but also what you have to do with the bits. So you have to test, for instance, that whether the number you're currently using is smaller than 12 or something, or smaller than 13. And those tests also have to be done in an oblivious fashion, in a secure way, and they add up to the total effort to do the algorithm. So you have to strike a balance between those things, and then our algorithm will give an advantage, well, depending on the setting. There's lots of settings, but in certain cases, it will still give an advantage. And remember, the waste was only 1.11 compared to 0.578 or something. So in that regard, there's hardly a difference. So you can use this kind of algorithm as a drop-in replacement in many papers that that actually need random numbers, joint random numbers in the secure computation, and then they waste a bit more, and then you can use this kind of thing. So that was some, say, further or other result. Just to close this topic, there's also the issue of going in the other direction. And then we want to extract as many random bits from this uniform random value. That question was also considered in this NIST draft. And well, they gave a very simple algorithm. That was nice, but no analysis. But you can derive in a similar fashion that that you only lose, say, in this case, you lose 2 bits. On average. And if you like, you can also determine the variance and all that kind of quantities. So now I want to switch to the construction of pseudo-random bit generators again, that we just used as a kind of primitive to do other things. I guess the setting is well known. From a small string, supposedly uniformly random, we want to expand that one to a very long string that looks random. And we like to work in the setting of provably secure pseudorandom generators, and for that we will use reductions. We don't know anything else to do. And we like to reduce to some hard problem, and preferably to a problem that gained some credits so in the past, so not your own problem that you just found or cooked up, but a problem that is also shared with others and over time. So here's a slide on that issue. So what you see these days is actually lots of papers with rather strong assumptions, so it doesn't stop at this level, there's much more there. There's two opposing forces here. We want to stay on this side, because then it's a pure assumption, something that's nicely formulated in a mathematical way, etc., in general. And then on the other side, we can maybe more easily get a reduction, a more tight reduction. So we will end up somewhere in the middle. Today, we will end up here, this for now. And then if we take into account concrete security, of course, the nice thing is that that even though we know or we suspect that these problems are not entirely equivalent, the only thing we know to do when switching to concrete security is to say that, well, for the DDH problem, we don't know of any reduction between these two, so we will use the same security parameters as for the DL problem. So we have to ensure that the DDH problem is hard, and then we say, oh, what's the best algorithm for discrete logarithms, index calculus, and then based on that, we choose our parameters. But that's the way it goes. So I'm happy to discuss this, but I don't know of alternatives. So that's what we do, because prior results in this family, say pseudorandom generators based on this problem, they focus on the discrete log problem itself mostly, but they don't use the DDH directly. But we will do that, and since that's a stronger assumption, we will end up with actually an easy reduction and a tight one even, or scoot as tight. So we will use the standard notion of security for the pseudo-random generators, where the distinguisher must make up his mind facing one sequence from two potential sources. And one technical remark is that we will use worst case T, so the running time is bounded by T as an upper bound, not on the average. So to make that a bit more concrete, and we are in this situation, we have this distinguisher that we assume, the attacker for the pseudorandom generator, and then we want to reduce to the known problem. And then we want to have, for the time success ratio, we want to have no loss in that, tight reduction. And if that's not possible, we want to have this as close to this one, of course. But if it's gets further apart, then of course we are not so happy, and we don't get good concrete security. And this slide is just to make sure that we all look at this same basic notion of pseudo randomness as introduced by Yao a long time ago. So that is the setting. And now we will look at some potential solutions. And I will draw these solutions in this form, which is self-explanatory, I think. We have a seed value, we have a next state function to move from state to state, and we will have an output function to extract some information, some bits from each state. So that's the idea. And now we have that was our first so a somewhat older attempt, which actually is a good generator, but here we are still at looking at such a say modern assumption, which is not in the same category yet as the DDH problem, so of the DDH assumption. So the decision Diffie-Hellman inversion problem with parameter k is the problem to distinguish between a sequence of this form, increasing powers of a, and then in this place position the inverse of A, and in this sequence there's a random value. So you have to distinguish with this random value, but given this extra information. And because of that extra information, you cannot simply reduce to the DDH problem, of course. If we are a bit flexible here in interpreting this K, if we can choose that as long as the sequence that we want to generate, and then make the assumption that this is still indistinguishable, then we can do something along these lines, where we pick a universal hash function indexed by this y, and we will extract bits from successive powers here of G with this fixed A in there. Yeah, sorry. Oh yeah, yeah. That's correct. Thank you. Yes, the A is missing. Yeah. Oh. Oh yeah, yeah. That's maybe I copied over here, but then lost somewhere behind these boxes. Yeah, true. That there's no good reason for that. So yeah, no. But I just inserted the slide to show an old attempt, which actually gives a result, but on the at a rather high price because of this assumption. And maybe you know that at EuroCup 2006, this assumption was investigated a bit more thoroughly, and then showed some potential problems or weaknesses which can be circumvented, but you have to be careful with such a new assumption. But okay, and now I have this say practical proposal from this draft by Barker and Kelsey, December 2005. So several people actually noticed this independently. We hit on this draft at some point, and then well, it's kind of obvious that this generator cannot be secure because they really designed it much too tight, say, or in a different way than I'm using in the rest of the talk. What they were doing is what we're looking at is something with entropy of 256 bits, these states, because they are in this field. And at each iteration, we want to extract 240 bits. So that that's because 2 to the power 256 divided by 2 to the power 240 is only 2 to the power 16. It gives only, on average, 2 to the power 16 possibilities if you've seen this output. And that's too small, given another effect that I will just show. So For this generator, there was actually a positive result also in the beginning of this year, which shows that these sequences are fine, but extracting bits this way and so many bits is it's not a good idea. There's simply too many, but even if you would do less bits, take less bits here, then you still wouldn't achieve provability. So because this was put in a draft, we actually want to execute the, say, the crypt analysis of this generator by simply implementing it in a program and then looking at those output blocks and counting or determining how probable they are, and from that concluding that it's not actually random. So here's the, well, the basic idea is that if you look at these output blocks, then the point is that if such a point is mapped to an output block, so if an output block results from such a point, it automatically puts that block into, say, a class or which has more elements than some other classes. Or the fact that this block occurs is biased. So the blocks with more elements will occur more often. I try to put it like this. So a really random block would just occur with probability 1 over 2 to the power 16. I have to say differently. There's 2 to the power 16 of these blocks. That would maybe end up here, but if we look at the blocks of this form that result from a point on the curve like this, they will have on average more than 2 to the power 16 elements. And well, there's another slide. That means that we can simply count. If we look at a block, then we count how many points result in this block, because we can do that because we can just enumerate all the possible x coordinates. We have already the first 240 bits, so we are just missing 16 bits to the power 16 possibilities. That gives us the x coordinate. Then we check whether there's a point with that coordinate on the curve, and then probably of the, there's two of them, and we increment the counter by two, and then we have counted all of them. Right? So we can just do that, and based on that, if that number is too high, and if that happens too often, then we say that the entire sequence is not random, and otherwise it would be random. And you can see that the resulting distribution will approach a normal distribution, but it's slightly shifted to the right. It we see by one, it's shifted to the right, and that indicates that this is not a random sequence. And it was just to make a concrete cryptanalysis of this proposal. That, and John Kelsey appreciated this because I think the point was with this proposal that it was to fill in the gap of, say, provably secure generators or somehow provably secure concrete, whatever, generators, as opposed to the practical ones. But this was neither provably secure, well, nor secure, so and also not efficient, so it didn't fit in the picture. So they should look for a really secure, provably secure generator, and then preferably with a good performance. So that was, say, a bad example. Now we're going to look at a good example, the good old Bloom-Micali construction for the discrete log setting. That's a very nice theoretical result, or it comes with a reduction proof. The idea is that because if you work modulo prime p, then the group elements, you can view them as numbers as well. So that means that you can reuse this this state x as an exponent again and iterate this, and then you look whether it's in the first half or in the second half modulo p to give you one bit of output in each iteration. So that's a good idea. The only disadvantage is that it's not a very tight reduction. This is what you get, and well, that's what you see in many of these constructions. It's not so easy, or maybe not possible at all, to make this reduction much tighter. You just get stuck. Somehow you run into the limits of the say the reductionist approach. If you have this construction and you have that assumption, then there's a bound to the limit to the reduction that you can achieve for that case. So that means that you either have to change the construction or find a new assumption to get better concrete results. So for later comparison, we've put up this slide here to see what means or when this construction becomes secure in a certain sense. And for that we have to say make an estimate. Extrapolate on the results for discrete logarithms known so far, and this based on the number field sieve and some other of papers out there, like the one by Landstraff and Hull, putting some concrete numbers. And that's the best we can do for concrete security. Yeah, that those are only estimates, of course. We cannot know exactly how much it will take if we want to have a secure one, or not one that can be tested by running the algorithm and the experiment. So we have to satisfy this condition, and well, the left side is polynomial in n, and the right side sub-exponential, so at some point this will give a solution, this will become small enough compared to the right-hand side, and we actually came to this value, you need a prime modulus of 61,000 bits to get this level of security. But clearly that's a long modulus. Also gives rise to a high seed length. And our goal is to improve on this. And well, the plan, well, our general plan was to look at stronger assumptions, as strong as needed. But well, for the DDH assumption, we somehow were looking in the wrong direction. But actually, inspired also by this dual elliptic curve construction, the solution was much easier to imagine. So that's what I'm going to present now next. So this is the standard DDH assumption. And well, in the concrete analysis, we will use the same parameters as we used for the DL problem. We will also apply them to the DDH problem. Right? So we get that problem for free, so to speak. So here's some more background. Actually, so later we realized that now Reingold also did something based on the DDH assumption in a paper on pseudorandom functions. And he actually wrote, I think, that this would be a pseudorandom generator, because the reason being that the idea is that you fix the group, you fix this exponent, and then you will use many B's to apply this function to obtain two more values. So this has, is say, one size of one group element, and here you have two of them. And they are indistinguishable from random because of the DDH. So you double the input in a sense. However, well, I think they even wrote something like this would be a pseudorandom generator. But well, you can argue about the meaning of a pseudorandom generator. But maybe I could just say it's not a pseudorandom bit generator, because this doesn't give bits. And the problem is, because these are not bits, you cannot reiterate. You cannot take this value g to the b and input it again here in this function. So the idea of well, in a very theoretical sense, a pseudorandom generator is just something that expands its input and it looks random. But also the idea is that you can reiterate. And for that you need, say, bit strings here and not group elements. Maybe the group elements are bit strings, so that will also be our case. But then you still need to do a proper form of extraction. So that's actually what I just was arguing. But this was in retrospect. Sorry. For the function, yeah, true. That's why they actually use this. Yeah. Well, maybe I could rephrase that. You have to find the proper extractor here. What? Oh, okay. Yeah, sorry. Maybe the later slides help a bit. So because well, this is not exactly phrased as an extractor, but it has a similar function. So this is our proposal. And phrased in general terms for an arbitrary group where we assume the where we work under the DDH assumption. And we will actually use two fixed group elements, chosen at random, but fixed throughout the generator. And here are the seed values. And now the point is that, what I was just saying, in a way, is that, okay, here we have a group element. X is an element of the group, and S is a bit string. And we can compute this exponentiation. And from that group element, we want to extract bit strings again. But if we would just use only the group element, we get stuck in most cases. There's one exception, but usually we will get stuck. So then the idea is to add a further random bit string as input, or you can view it as a number. And because of this extension, we can actually make this into a bijection. And as these also these parts match in size, the G and the ZQ, and this is of course the same part, we can now reiterate this. So that's the important thing. This is not exactly the same as an extractor, where we were using the same Y all the time. We call it a bijection to just transform the group element along with some random value into two random numbers, or I could say. And we perform, if we use this idea both in the next state function and in the output function. So for that we reserved this second group element Y, but we use the same S, and now this Z goes to the output, and the RY will be recycled, because that's also the point that we can recycle the RX and the RY. So that's the idea, and so that this kind of postulates this enum function, but for the group, for each group under consideration, we would have to specify one, of course, and that's now the problem to get specific instances. But this is the general construction. Okay, so we'll actually formulate a theorem for this, but before that, well, let's say the following. There's this discrepancy that here we have elements of numbers modulo q, and we actually want to go to bit strings, and that's easy. So that's easy if q is close to a power of 2. Then you can just copy q to the output, or copy the number modulo q to the output, because the statistical distance will be small. And otherwise, well, we can go back to what I told before. We have this problem of extracting random bits from a random number modulo q, and we have to pay a small price, but we can still get many bits out there. Only problem is that the number of bits that we take out will start to vary, so maybe that's in practice not so nice, but okay. So for the first case, if q is close to the power of 2, then we get this result that formulated in a concrete fashion, that for the generator, for the attacker, and for the underlying problem, there's the same running time, and there's this reduction in success probability, and this is actually n divided by m is the number of outputs of the generator, the number of blocks output by the generator, or 1 over k is that, of the number of blocks, and that's the factor that we lose because we use the standard hybrid argument. So actually sketched the hybrid proof for this, but so what we do is we will have to hide an instance of the DDH problem, a four tuple, in such in these output sequences, and these are the hybrids that we will form. And we pick a random position. Until that point, we take random values, and then at that critical position, we stick in the x and y from the given tuple, and then we finish the entire sequence by following the algorithm of the PRG. And then there's two cases that if this x, y is indeed a Diffie-Hellman tuple, then these will already have the same exponent compared to G, and therefore you can see it already as an iteration of the pseudo-random number generator, because in that one we use the same exponent s, if you remember. So we have the same s here and here. So that happens in the generator. And if it's not such a Diffie-Hellman tuple, or it should be a DH tuple, then we end up in the hybrid next to it. And that will give the distinguishing. So I will close by giving two instances that we can easily get now. So these are actually very practical ways to do it. We are working modulo prime p. For simplicity, we can take safe prime here. Then this order of the subgroup is also prime, but that's not essential. And then we use this nice bijection. We only need one input, so the second input you can view it as an empty one. That's allowed. We don't need it. We don't need to recycle these other values. We just have this simple bijection, and we actually learned it through this paper, but then I think Martijn Stam pointed out to us that it's already in this one, or at least in the extended version, and well, would not be surprised if people already know this idea for so this mapping quadratic residues to the numbers modulo q. And the idea is that if it's small, you just copy it, and otherwise you take the negative the negated value of it. And if x is a quadratic residue, then minus x is not a quadratic residue for this p. So then you won't hit another one, and everything will be fine. So this is the actual construction, and we actually extract a huge number of bits about the entropy of the state at each iteration. So that's very good. What does it mean concretely? So we had this one for comparison. We will use the same security level, the same security goal. And well, the answer turns out to be using the same digits, but one less, 1600. So 1600 bit modulus to get this security level, and that's I think practitioners then start to listen. So that can be done. So clearly this is based on a much tighter reduction to okay, a bit stronger assumption, but it should be fine. And then here we see the construction in more generality. Now we switch to an arbitrary subgroup to make the thing more general. It doesn't give performance gain so much, but it's a more general case. And for that we reserve an element of order L in CP star. And we take an element here of the subgroup of order Q, and then we multiply it with this other element to the power R, so that you can imagine these values as being lined up in a matrix. So horizontally, in the first row you put all the group elements, and in the next row you put T times the group elements, that coset, and then you continue. And you use, in that big matrix, you use these two values to select a row and a column. And the entire matrix is of the size of the group and contains every element of the group exactly once. So this will be a unique group element. And then it's actually arbitrary how you split it up, break this up again to get to a value modulo Q and a value modulo L. But this is the most obvious way, I would say. And the result is then this again, just following the general format. So that brings me to the final slide, where I think the most important remark is that we would really like to do this for elliptic curve discrete logarithm groups, because that would result in much shorter seeds. And we are now stuck with this modulo prime case. We tried this idea of Kalisky, where he works with the curve and its twist, and then you can define a bijection between those two and say some ZS or for some S, and so a consecutive range of integers. That exists, but still we didn't succeed in getting the construction so that it gives a proof and it reduces to the DDH and not some DDH on E or DDH on the twist or some funny variant. Maybe we will concede and take such a variant, but we would like to just use the standard DDH assumption for the elliptic curves to apply the same construction. That's it. Questions?
What?
Yeah, if it has the bijection, and you need those extra random bits that we are recycling, this Rx and Ry, so we are recycling these bits to do that. So if you have a group element and maybe some extra input, and then map to via bijection to some integer. If that integer contains the same entropy as the input, then then actually you're doing this. And we looked at extractors, but as far as I understand, this doesn't qualify exactly as an extractor, but that maybe we are missing something there. But, does that help? Or the yeah, so if you look at this pair, x to the power s and y to the power s, we are also using those two values for a fixed x and y, and this would be the B input. So that's the same, but we're actually using these additional values, and that I don't see in the in their construction or in their pseudo-random function.
Not taking the whole tree construction, like normal. Because if you take the whole tree construction, then you would need to worry so much about extraction because you have a random function. But I guess you want to put it only in one step to be more efficient. You don't want to go all the way down to tree, right?
I guess so. Yeah. I want to save some trees. Yeah. So.
Variability in the number of bits that you get out of each integer mod 2. Suppose that you want something that doesn't have any variability, for instance, to stop timing side channels, then what's the most efficient solution to that?
I don't know one really, I think. Or maybe you know one, but.
Well, if you clearly do something like they have the bits, that's surely random enough, but.
But I think there could be cases that you even go below. Half of the bits. So you extract on average at least n minus 2 bits, so you lose 2, but in the worst case you probably can walk along the borderline or the almost to the end and then just take a right turn just before the destination, and then you only get one bit out of it. So you cannot even put a lower bound on it that you would always get. Yeah, so we just put the Bloom-Macaulay generator as a well-known one, and just for comparing, yeah. So in the discrete log setting, there's lots of further results where you extract more than one bit, and hardcore bits, simultaneous hardcore bits, that kind of constructions, and similarly in the RSA setting. So you can get more bits, but what we actually saw with Bloom-Schoop is if you go from one bit to several bits, the gain is not enormous. So so the Fazirani-Fazirani result is this well-known O of log n with the hidden constant, but the hidden constant is huge or rather small, if depending on how you look at it. Well, rather small, I think. So we also made concrete analysis of those things, and it was still disappointing. To you would only get a few random bits out per iteration, so five or six, and in a way that was the best thing to do, and it was still disappointing. And that's all due to the fact that the basic reduction, which is in some sense optimal, Fischl and Schnorr somehow concluded this, or that is very inefficient. So we are looking at somewhat incompatible things, an assumption and a construction which are too far apart. Yes? Well, 1024 is the magic number these days, and I'm not sure how often these generators, like the Bloom-Schoop even, which is well known, are used in practice. Yeah. I didn't put those kind of things on the slides, but that's what is used in practice in many standards, and also in the standard that I mentioned by Barker and Kelsey, there's lots of stuff on that. And then they wanted to have a section on provably secure. But this one didn't do, I would say. But, yeah?
Can you break all these by doing these three bonds, or have you got these two sided? I already know how to break one bomb two by factoring, so now people never seem to ask the question.
Well, if you factor, you only get this one bit, then you still have a problem. To put it slightly around, if you use a very small modulus, an RSA modulus of 80 bits or 40 bits, something small, and you just run Bloom-Schoop and then do statistical tests on those things, they will still pass the test. So these tests that are used by NIST and that's the FIPS and the Die Hard is a popular thing. If you do a somewhat decent job, you will pass these tests, but still it doesn't mean that much. And what we saw with this dual elliptic curve generator is really that we know the construction, we just see how it works, and we see a problem, and then that's the statistical test. So if you see the construction, then you're better off, but in practice often you don't know what's exactly happening. And yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's not clear. But it's possible. Is it possible that one Macaulay is more secure because it's got some fewer bits?
So the standard Bloom-Schoop is also outputting a single bit, huh?
Sure.
Is yeah.
It possible that one Macaulay is more secure?
The reductions don't say the whole story. Yeah. So there might be.
But in the PRD1.
Oh yeah, that one, yeah. Yeah, so maybe Bloom-Schoop has an extra line of defense there. That, yeah, that with one bit, well, you also have to go from maybe a distinguisher to a solver, or to the actually reconstructing the state, and that's also, you have to pay a big price there. That. Break, huh?
Yeah.
Oh.
what's the thing that you know about the elliptic curve?
It was some time ago, so we tried.
You know how to prove anything about them, you know how to construct them, but you don't know how to prove.
So I put, say the natural construction. I don't remember how it was, but the one that you would like to work, and then
so you
but I was if I'm here this I'm out
So to get an extra construction, you can have think it works, but you can't prove.
So you have a group element, and you have a bit string x, and then you see whether this corresponds to the point on the curve itself or to the twist, mm-hmm. and that gives you actually a group element, mm-hmm. And then there's this bijection from those things back. But if you try to apply the hybrid lemma, then if you want to hide in one of the DDH for the curve itself and not for the twist, then we cannot simulate it for the twist.
But eventually, when the algorithm runs,